This is community radio for Sonoma County and the world. This is radio station KWTF, and now another presentation of Voices from Behind the Walls with your host, Albert Big Man Howard.
This is Albert Big Man Howard, your host for Voices from Behind the Walls, coming to you once again from KWTF Community Radio. And we're presenting more from the writings of Eddie Marshall, from his book called Martial Law. And this radio program, of course, is to present the writings of incarcerated writers from their published works. And today we have reading for us Marty McReynolds and David Engel.
This is David Engel reading Chapter 11, The Bowels of Hell. It was sometime in 1977 when Kay said to me, in that way that women do when they are calling you on your responsibility, "You need to talk to your son." I knew that she was right. He was fast becoming a young adult, and prison had put too much space between us. Kay and I had separated before I was imprisoned, and because of the fact that I was often on lockup during the first 7 years of my incarceration, I had not seen her or Ronald very much. During those years, I was in survival mode, and consequently had given very little thought to parenting, though my son had always been in my heart. Yet I knew it was time to become a father, and the relationship between child and parent was such that the boundaries of prison walls did not exist, though they were always there. Fatherhood had been for me an odd state of being in which, on one hand, I had always been proud of the human beings I had helped to create, but on the other hand, I was nagged by concerns about the lives my children would lead and how the world would treat them. In addition, imprisonment offers more than its share of complications for the parent who is behind bars. Ronald was doing what many teens at that time were doing, drinking, hanging out on the streets, and running with his boys. I'm sure he was giving Kay the blues, though she never admitted it. I recalled my own teen years. I was not rebellious with my parents, but I'm certain that some of my exploits caused them to worry. Looking back now, I clearly see how, as a young man, I had failed to look at how my actions would impact others. I had been in search of myself, and I had taken a few wrong turns along the way. When I found out that my son was in the midst of the throes of the same search for self, I felt happy and proud for a moment. After that, I grew concerned. Would Ronald make the same mistakes and experience the same mishaps that I had? The world was not the place it had been when I was growing up. It only took one look at the growing prison population to confirm that. I wanted Ronald to continue to grow and have those experiences in life that make us wise, but not before his time, and I wanted to guide him along the way. So I made a decision that would bring us closer together. One of the community programs that the comrades and I had developed was a 10-week counseling program for youth who were troubled and at high risk of coming into the criminal justice system. Some of the young people were court-appointed, but parents inside and outside of the prison could request help from this program. Well, this turned out to be one of the few times that I actually needed a program that I had implemented. I asked Cheryl Waters, a close friend and schoolteacher, to bring Ronald to the program. She would pick him up from home once a week and bring him to the prison for the sessions, and then return him to his home in the evening. This gave me the opportunity to talk to my son for 2 hours each week without the guards hovering or the other barriers to our communication that were presented by the visiting room. I had always tried to let Ronald make his own decisions, and now it became even more important for him to make his own choices in life, but I was determined to be able to influence him enough to make healthy ones. My own experience had taught me that when we are young, we might listen to the advice of elders, but when it came down to it, we would still do what we thought was best for ourselves. I wanted to be supportive of whatever Ronald wanted to do with his life. My approach was to discuss whatever Ronald wanted to talk about, and then look at any possible choices he could make. We would examine things from both the positive and negative perspective, and then discuss his thoughts. Sometimes we would just sit there quietly for a time, while Ronald decided on a course of action. Those were some of the best times for me, because they gave me a sense of humanness in the midst of what is really an abnormal and inhumane environment. The joy of watching my son grow, and not just in physical terms, but emotionally and intellectually, coupled with the fact that I was guiding him into adulthood, was priceless. Though Ronald has gone on to achieve many things, I have never been as proud of him as I was in that moment when I watched him ponder his future and become a man. All these years later, looking over his shoulder as he teaches at Bowling Green State University in Ohio, I like to think that in some small way I helped to give him that chance. I have helped numerous other young people along the way, but obviously none of those situations had been as rewarding as this experience with Ronald. Meanwhile, tension was building again in the prison, and sleepless nights had become routine for some members of the population. A heavy slumber would remain elusive as long as this electricity crackled throughout the prison, sparking fights in its wake.
Fire!
Someone yelled the words out deep in the night, and it was as if all those emotional sparks had finally caught and threatened to consume the prison. I must confess I have learned to sleep through what most people might find unimaginable. Stabbings, fightings, and all types of noise. And this night was no exception. I was awakened by my cell buddy who informed me that the fire was burning several doors up from us. The guards were unable to open the door to the burning cell because they were not allowed to have keys upstairs after midnight. This regulation was a result of the 1972 riot. All the keys for the cell blocks were locked in the guard's post desk to be given out by a lieutenant, so the fire burned out of control. They had to run downstairs to the guard post to get the keys, and by the time they got back, the flames were leaping from the cell, making it impossible to approach the door. The firefighting equipment was so old and useless that it had little effect on the fire. The cells in the Maryland Penitentiary had been painted hundreds of times in as many years, causing a buildup on the walls that was so heavy you could dig for hours and never see the steel wall. In most cases, no one ever tried to clean the old paint away once they moved into a cell. The occupant would simply get some paint and redo the cell the way they wanted it to look. This paint was highly flammable, and once ablaze, it was almost impossible to put out. Thus, the cell had become completely engulfed in flames, and the lack of fire hoses on the housing units made this a situation of criminal proportions. Amongst the 1,300 men housed in the facility, there were only a small number of handheld fire extinguishers, and no heavy firefighting equipment at all. The locks themselves dated back to the 1930s and had to be opened one at a time. This greatly impacted the situation because it meant that the guards had to come in close contact with the fire in order to release the now very desperate men who were caged in those cells. Over half the prisoners on the tier were still trapped in their cells, and the panic was spreading. Worse yet, the guards were also running around in a state of confusion, not certain what action they should take. The minutes lost could easily mean lives lost. There didn't seem to be enough keys to immediately release everyone, and all the prisoners in the cells above and below were now frantic. Eventually, the guards managed to get the fire under control, but two members of the new family gang were killed in the fire, a godfather and a lieutenant. There was immediate suspicion that this was a hit, and the population was on edge. The prison administration would experience the real inferno the following day because we were all mad as hell by the time we got out of those cells. Several protests were staged the next day, and the list of issues was long. A lack of access to the keys to unlock the doors at night, the absence of firefighting equipment in the prison, and the fact that it really had not been noticed before, as well as the paint buildup. The fact that the guards had to go all the way back down to the guard station to get the keys to open the cell, rather than having a lever-throwing device at the end of the tier to free people in the event of an emergency, was yet another issue that needed to be addressed. An automatic opening device would have saved lives and freed other prisoners from their cells instead of trapping them inside where they suffered from smoke inhalation. That so many men had found themselves trapped in their cells nagged at us all. We all wondered what would happen if more than one cell was on fire at the same time, since we had barely escaped from this fire. Suddenly, the tension between the various groups of prisoners had been replaced with serious concern and discussion about fire safety. These discussions spread across the yard like a current, and finally, there was a flat refusal to return to those cells until someone could guarantee that the locking devices would be changed. The word on the yard was that a number of complaints had been made to the officials in recent months, but most had gone unanswered. By the time the warden got into the yard, the men were worked up and began to hurl question after question at him. This resulted in a shouting session and nothing was resolved. However, the warden agreed to meet with a group of representatives from the population. Unfortunately, the meeting only proved that there was a gross lack of communication between us and the prison administration. It was agreed that we needed an ongoing forum to deal with the issues that kept popping up and remained largely unresolved. The way to deal regularly was through something like an inmate advisory committee. The warden agreed to allow such a committee to be set up and promised a regular monthly meeting with such a body of prisoners to deal with agreed-upon agendas. The other issues were to be worked on, and by the time we met again, the administration would answer questions about the locking devices and the other issues, and we would have a charter and some bylaws to govern the formulation of an advisory committee. So we went back to the population with the information, and things were somewhat under control at this point. We got started on the paperwork for the inmate advisory committee, because we knew that one of the conditions was that all the paperwork had to be approved by the warden before we could be allowed to officially operate as a body of prison representatives, and this could become a delaying tactic. There would be an election and one-year terms, and all this would require a six-month waiting period. We got together and, after some discussion, it was agreed that it would be even better if the population had an organized structure to deal with the administration in future encounters. One thing we wanted was to have more control over the funds and the programs that were coming into the penitentiary. We also wanted to communicate directly with the administration without having to go through the on-the-yard act of resistance every few months. The situation always held the potential for violence and never resolved anything anyway until we met with the officials, so why not just establish a means of dealing with them on a regular basis? Once we got the charter and bylaws approved, we set up an election for the coming month. I did not run for any of the official positions because of all the double talk and bullshit that was required to deal with the administration. But because I had been one of the regular prison leaders and had originally been selected to meet with the warden after the fire, I had to continue acting as part of the ad hoc advisory committee until the six-month time period was over, and the elected officers could take their positions. As a result of the original situation on the yard that day after the fire, the tension was still very high, and a lot of little beefs were developing between the prisoners and the guards. The officials tried to distract the population from the real issues, so they used the fire to manipulate the situation for their own interests. Soon it was being suggested that the fire was started as part of a gang war. The officials went a step further and locked up a number of people from different groups, gangs, and organizations. They finally put the word out that the collective was behind the hit, and soon they locked up one of our members and he was held incommunicado. The rumors that went around the yard ranged from the story that the fire was the result of a hit that I had ordered to the smoking in bed theory. The bigger problem was that there was a lot of tension, as well as a struggle for leadership in the new family gang, which resulted in a lot of talk about someone hitting back. At the time, I don't even think they cared who they struck out at, as long as they took some action. The leadership of the collective was in the spotlight, and we had to be very careful how we handled this situation. We had to take some time out and meet with a number of groups and factions of the gang to set the record straight. While this was going on, the officials continued to fan the flames in hopes that an incident would take some of the heat off of them. The newspapers were asking the same questions that we had asked about the locking system and the lack of a prevention program. Heads were going to roll and things were looking bad for the administration. The situation in the yard was rather tight for a few days after the incident, since the gang leader who had died had been, in fact, one of the administration's key informants. Their other informants were scared to death that they would be next, so they were more than willing to help the administration move on the collective's membership. The information being put out by these informants and unofficially by the officials was beginning to take root and create problems. Much debate was going on in the yard about the right and wrong of such attacks. There were a few hotheads on both sides, and many were feeding into the rumors out of fear, anger, or ignorance. Yet the general population knew the real story and refused to be played by the officials and their use of informants. The potential for violence was very high, but there was not a single incident in the yard among the prisoners. The new family had been and remained one of the administration's main tools in the prison, but the fact of the matter was that it had also gotten completely out of hand. It was increasingly difficult for the administration to keep them in check. New members were trying to gain leadership and move the gang into the drug game. Up until that point, the gang had been involved in small-time stuff like winemaking. Now the drug game was a problem for the administration, since the profits could be used to corrupt the guard force, which was always ready to do anything for a few dollars. Since the family had aided the administration in its effort to stop the union drive, and had helped keep the youthful population involved in gang wars rather than politics, the officials turned a blind eye to their activities. Once the drugs started to come in, there was pressure put on the faction that was into the drug scene. The different gangs in the prison made something like firebombing very likely. And though the different gangs in the collective had been in conflicts before, very few physical contacts were made simply because the collective was always working in the interests of the general population, and a little gang of killers didn't stand a chance in the face of the popular support we had. We were just too strong for anyone to want trouble from us, and in turn, we never tried to deal with the gangs or cliques on any level other than to educate them. Our members were the bad dudes in the prison long before they became members, so we didn't have anything to prove. The members had all spent months and years in training in the martial arts and teaching others these skills. The ties and connections we had developed throughout the prison were very strong. Many of the other organizations in the prison were able to organize and develop because of our support during their initial formation. So we had very strong ties to almost all the organizations that had structure and discipline. And finally, the collective was always working in the interest of the population. That won us no less than 100 active supporters, so our numbers were very great in the general population of 1,300. For all those reasons, the collective members rarely found themselves in physical combat with anybody, gangs or individuals. The respect for the collective was very high, and only from time to time did minor conflicts between individual members develop. These beefs would usually be worked out by a group of friends and associates of the principals involved. Very rarely was there an actual fight or the use of physical force. Now, it was a known fact that the collective continued to work against what we thought were the disruptive and negative influences of the new family. The forced participation of newly arrived youth into the drug and sex culture of the gang was actively opposed through our education programs and individual rap sessions with the new arrivals. On the other hand, because we continued to be the group in the forefront of most of the organizing in the prison, we stepped on a lot of toes, most often offending those involved in drug dealing, because this was counter to what we wanted for our community and the future of our youth. We knew that there was a need for better communication among members of the prison population. Thus, the first major seminar we put together in the penitentiary was organized around the need for communication development. The staff of the prison library played a key role in the effort to organize this seminar and bring together members of the Baltimore community and the prison population. The planning and coordinating was done by a small group of politically conscious prisoners, working closely with a very progressive librarian and with outside community supporters who also came from a progressive background. The seminar brought together a number of communications and media specialists from the surrounding community, and a number of prisoners with a strong interest in communicating among ourselves and with the world outside. Many of the individuals involved with our newspaper were also involved with the seminar. The event took place in the auditorium, and over 150 people attended. The four-day-long program was broken up into a series of workshops that focused on four key areas: a newspaper for the prison, a television station for the prison, a radio station for the prison, and the development of more programs to benefit the population. On the fifth day, we reconvened as a group and devoted most of the time to reports from the various workshops and follow-up discussions. We were asking for a commitment from the prisoners and the outside guests to continue the work that was begun during the seminar and to support future initiatives. One of the most important things that came out of the seminar was a lasting network of media and communications experts who continued to support us in our efforts to develop progressive media and outreach programs. Though the goals of the seminar were large ones, they weren't entirely out of the realm of possibility. In 1978, television and radio stations were a reality in other prisons, and we wanted to develop our media program along similar lines. The possibility existed for us to create in-house programming and to do closed-circuit broadcasting of both television and radio, strictly within the prison walls. And the sad fact of the matter is that the officials agreed to allow us the opportunity to set up these programs within the next 6 months, and then reneged on their commitment to us. Not to be deterred, we continued to work towards getting a class set up and having instructors brought in who would teach journalism courses to a small group of us, who would then publish an official penitentiary newspaper. We successfully completed the courses and established a newspaper in the prison. Not the first one, of course, but the first official one. We also established our own courses on radio programming and set up our own radio station unofficially. Each night, we would come on the air at 11:30 and broadcast until midnight. Every couple of days, it would be moved to another location. As it turned out, the whole seminar process was a good one for planning, organizing, and carrying out programs and activities in the prison. We continued to carry on other work in different areas with different ends in mind. Of course, the conditions of the penitentiary never got any better, no matter how hard we worked on them. It seemed like they were built into the system. The level of oppression, the conditions unfit for human habitation, these were institutionalized already. There were times when it honestly seemed like nothing would or could work to change the conditions we were living with. The more we organized, the more the officials tried to disrupt our efforts. Among members of the general population, it seemed that no one cared about these conditions or the level of oppression that prisoners experienced on a daily basis. It was out of fashion and no longer the thing to do in law and order America. The left was losing the ability to organize support for radical issues, and the community at large was starting to feel the impact of the massive FBI misinformation programs about prisoners and radical groups. Being very supportive of the prisoners' groups was a risky business at that time in America. The public newspapers were working overtime to print negative stories about the prisoners and the criminal element in general. The positive things we were doing were receiving no exposure at all. The things that the guards were doing to us were largely unreported or reported in the light that made the guards' behavior seem reasonable, or as though they were the only course of action under the conditions.
This is Marty McReynolds continuing with Chapter 11 of Martial Law by Marshal Eddie Conway. We had to find a way to get our side of the story out to the public in general, or at the very least to some individuals on the outside we felt might be able to exert a degree of control over our situation. We decided to send out periodic newsletters to elected officials and community leaders to keep them informed of the happenings inside the prison. These would be professional newsletters with detailed information, dealing with anything that affected us specifically or with the general conditions within the prison. Our objective was twofold. First, this was a way of keeping representatives and community leaders informed about our situation. Second, the publicity would put the administration under the spotlight, and, we hoped, cause them to check some of their actions and behavior toward the prisoners. This effort, although secret, involved a great many people on the level of information gathering. We had to steal records, orders, and memos from the offices and desks of the prison officials, get them copied, and put them back when we could. Their most loyal trustees did most of that stealing, and the results were explosive. We exposed the misuse of funds designated for the welfare of indigent prisoners. There were tens of thousands of dollars paid to guards that should have been going toward the welfare of prisoners. This had been going on for years, and the soap or toothpaste that we should have received never got there because the funds were going elsewhere. We also exposed a white supremacist clique within the prison guards, which had been working together with a group of racist prisoners to distribute hate materials and real weapons among the prison population, with the intent of creating confrontations between the white racist organization and the black prisoners. We managed to uncover information on the clique amongst the guards, as well as information about its leaders and their relationship to the KKK, and we made these facts known in one of our newsletters. We also began to notice that there was something strange going on with a number of prisoners who were undergoing psychiatric treatment in the prison hospital. At least twice a week, one of the prisoners would attack another prisoner for no apparent reason. The attacks were random and did not seem to have any basis. We would be sitting in the mess hall eating, and a prisoner would get up and walk over to another prisoner with his tray, take the tray, and hit the other man in the head repeatedly. Once this was stopped, the prisoner under attack would be shocked because he simply couldn't think of anything that could have provoked the attack. Almost a dozen of these incidents occurred before we could put enough pressure on the psychological ward to stop using these prisoners to maintain a level of violence so that they could justify their continuing demands for more funds. Guards and key officials were also using some of these mentally unstable individuals to attack selective targets among the population. There were a number of attacks directed toward the members of progressive organizations, in particular, members of the collective. The newsletter was instrumental in helping us to get the word out about this situation. The impact of those newsletters can never really be determined, but it is safe to say that shortly after the one on the psychological treatment ward, these attacks stopped altogether, or rather dropped back down to a normal level. We noticed real changes and saw real reactions to the newsletters. The information on the misuse of welfare funds was later used to file a court case about the issue. The administration made a lot of efforts to clean up the area we were writing about. We also discovered that illiteracy was a real problem within the prison population and started working to address it. In my opinion, it's the job of everyone who expresses concern for their people to teach as many of their community members as possible to read and write, to think and make decisions for themselves. To me, it seems that repressive political systems control the flow and development of most organizations by controlling who can do what, where, and how in these organizations. Therefore, the task of the activist is to aid in the development of a cadre among the oppressed people who will work in their interest and for their goals. Over the years, many political activists have asked themselves the question of where to find the people who will be trained to do this type of work. Answers have ranged from the working class to the middle class and the educated elite, and to the classless, the unemployed or the underemployed. No grouping or class has produced more progressive cadre than any other. And the answer will remain a secret until history comes forth at a later time with some proof. Right now, it is only important to create the responsible and skilled people who will be capable of helping to organize the masses in their own community. The method of learning becomes very important here. Since the beginning of record keeping, information has been held as a source of power and control. The elite has always directed or limited the education of the masses in general, and of the working class in particular. Society is structured in such a way as to make most types of education unreachable to the majority of the population. In most cases, the only education available to the masses is intended to develop them into a cohesive workforce ready to serve the interests of the ruling class. Education seems irrelevant to the everyday struggles people have to go through simply to survive, and the result is an increasingly high rate of illiteracy. If people can't see a direct relationship between what's taught in school and the struggle of everyday life, what reason is there for them to attend? The middle class does not have the same relationship with the educational system as do the poor and working classes. Their situation is not, in reality, so much different, but they are allowed into institutions that have a closer relationship with their employment goals and objectives. Most people in the school system are subjected to middle-class goals and values as projected by American culture and history. Thus, when most children come out of school, their primary goal is employment and middle-class status. After all, there are only so many management jobs and so many positions for doctors and lawyers. Many children, perhaps as many as 90% of high school graduates, end up in so-called blue-collar jobs. The rewards are high and real for the yuppies, while it seems more rewarding to the youth of the lower-class neighborhoods to drop out of school and involve themselves in some type of illegal activity or to just start a job as soon as possible. The bottom line is that they will end up in a low-paying job situation anyway. So in their minds, why go through all the school BS to reach the same ends? Another major factor affecting the education levels of the youth in our communities is the appeal that earning illegal money has. In America, the need for material goods to relate on a peer-to-peer level with other youth, both in and out of school, is probably greater than in any other nation. And for youth in working-class communities, these things are only attainable with money earned through illegal activities. Selling drugs and prostitution seem to be the major money-making avenues for many youth. And obviously, neither of these activities require much education. The illegal money is good and immediate. The effects of these actions on later life isn't really a concern for most youth. The overall outcome of this lack of relationship between education and employment is the high level of illiteracy in most poor and working-class communities. The levels of illiteracy in the oppressed and minority communities are even higher. The real reflection of this can best be seen in the prison population. There are criminals, crooks, and victims of all class levels and status positions, from upper middle class on down to the groups who have always operated outside the system class-wise and status-wise. Among these groups, you can see the relationship of education even in prison. The vast majority of the population of any American prison tends to be the local minority of that state. In the East, it is the people of African descent. In the West, it is the Native Americans and Latinos. In the Southeast, it is the Cubans and Haitians. Wherever you look, the education level among the minorities will be lower than among any other group. The issue of the over-Americanization of education is also a factor in many communities. Those of us in the collective thought an educational program that could speak to the history and specific situation of the group around us would be a particularly useful tool. So we took steps to organize such a program in the penitentiary. The concept was to allow everyone to get involved on an educational level, while bringing in massive support from the community to make the learning process a two-way street. The Brazilian educator, Paulo Freire, had already popularized a concept that was rapidly expanding around the world. Popular education, as he called it, based on the idea that when people are given the opportunity to voice their opinions about things they know, the learning process becomes a more positive experience among people, poor and oppressed in general. And they gain the ability to become more assertive in their daily dealings with their community problems and with the struggle for freedom and independence. People need the opportunity to develop an understanding of the world through their own environment and the interaction with their everyday existence. It is only through this type of education process that people feel that they have a voice to speak openly and to follow their own systems of belief. We felt we needed to develop a program that would bring prisoners together with people from communities in Baltimore so that we could collectively address the problems that were affecting us all. This type of interaction also fostered the confidence that many prisoners needed to step forward and voice their thoughts and views on what was affecting them in their daily lives. Just such a program was designed by a progressive librarian, Brenda Vogel. She had collaborated with us over the years to bring some level of consciousness into the Maryland penitentiary through speakers and other outside guests. And her new program was called To Say Their Own Words. It would live up to that title in all sorts of ways. Brenda and a group of her friends spent some time working on getting a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities to finance the program. They awarded her $250,000 to do a 50-week program that would involve up to 100 prisoners. There would be an internal staff of 7 prisoners and an external staff of 4 outside people. I was selected to coordinate the inside staff. From the very beginning, there was a buzz of excitement throughout the prison because the program would include a color camera and VCR, speakers and wireless mics, and a sophisticated sound system, and a number of outside guest speakers. These things were always a cause for excitement in the prison. The staff spent the first few weeks interviewing hundreds of men who wanted to take part in the program. There were some requirements for participation in the program. We needed people who would be in the penitentiary for the full length of the program, 52 weeks officially, but the program often had additional days added for special programs. Participants needed to have minimal reading skills, since there were many books that would be read before the program was completed. After a couple of weeks of these interviews, we selected 110 men to participate. Brenda began contacting the outside guests who would take part in this program. These guests were experts in a variety of fields. There would be over 50 of these speakers, and a number of community people from Baltimore and Washington, D.C. joining in the group discussions. Some of these speakers and participants came as far as 3,000 miles to participate in the program. They gave lectures and discussed subjects of interest to the prison population, with a great deal of attention paid to issues of importance to oppressed people. These lectures would become the focus of several follow-up programs. Every session was taped and recorded on the video equipment, enabling the programs to be used for future debates and discussions in other institutions. The amount of required reading was rather high, but it could not be helped. The program covered a lot of ground. Each participant had to complete one, sometimes two, books per week. The program started out with some very basic books that made for easy reading, and as it moved along, the materials got harder and more complex. Some participants read the required material and then found other related books to consume, while others only completed half the required materials. The books played an important part, but were not the key factor in the development of the program or of consciousness among the prisoners. That would result from the interactions and dialogues that prisoners would have among themselves. The first session of the program was held in the prison chapel, which was large enough to easily hold participants numbering over 100. The air was charged with electricity as everyone waited for the first lecture to begin. The program started slow, with the prisoners watching the speaker and the outside guests to gauge their reactions to being in the prison with us. In this type of situation, prisoners also watch each other to check their own behavior in a situation that presents new dynamics. As the speaker finished his lecture, and the audience watched and waited warily to see what would happen next, there was total silence. The organizers, those of us who were prisoners, and the others from the outside, wanted to see if the prison participants would take this program and make it their own. The program was surely doomed to failure if the men inside did not own it, so we all waited. Soon there was one question, and then another, and another. And it was not long before the whole place was in an uproar, and everyone wanted to get their 2 cents in. When the time ran out and our inaugural program was over with, no one wanted to leave. In the following weeks, we would see the program spark even greater interest. After each session, a number of the men would hang around in the library area assigned to the program, asking questions about the next programs and suggesting ways to make the program work better. Many of them offered their time and energy to the program, willing to do whatever tasks needed to be done. Since there were always box loads of new books coming in, and we all always needed help unloading them, this worked out quite well. Some men were trained as technicians on old black-and-white video equipment so that they would be prepared to learn on the new color equipment. Several were also trained as sound technicians. There was enough equipment for a full production studio. This helped to increase interest in the program because a number of prisoners wanted to learn skills that would lead to future employment possibilities. The comprehensive nature of this program allowed a number of semi-skilled paraprofessionals to be educated in many areas of programming. Camera crews were soon trained because the equipment would remain in the prison after the program ended. That would also allow for the production of other programs under the control and direction of the prisoners. The sound system was state-of-the-art for that time. It included mixing boards and shotgun mics. Some of the prisoners who developed skills would later become sound technicians for the entire prison system. The program served to develop a significantly large population of readers in the prison, increasing the number of requests for library books and materials tenfold.
This was the first time that a program had been able to engage a large segment of the prison population in a long-term project. Up to that point, no program, officially, had lasted that long. Most programs would suffer from the prisoners' lack of interest and simply fade out within a few months of inception. This program went the full year's time and was missed by its participants once it was over with. In fact, there would be attempts to develop a number of programs along the same lines as the original one. As the men in the prison began to feel ownership of this program, a collective consciousness developed. They discussed strategies to improve prison conditions, raise political awareness and consciousness among the population. Participants were scrambling to put their thoughts into action, so much so that on some nights the speaker and subject would be completely ignored while the group debated their own topic. These spontaneous discussions were sometimes prompted by recent occurrences in the prison, but it could be something in the news that caught someone's attention, or something that just came up during the discussion that very night. On the nights when this happened, the speaker would either get involved with the group or he or she would be left completely out of what was going on. There were always anywhere from 7 to 10 people from the outside community at each program. In most cases, these guests would always get involved, no matter what direction the program took. Throughout the duration of this program, very few discussions were actually sidetracked in this manner. But when this did occur, it was a learning experience for all involved. The guests and speakers left with a new understanding of prisoners and the reality of imprisonment in general. The debates that took place during the programs got so hot and heavy that prisoners filed out of the programs with debates still raging, and the outside people left by another door in heated discussions. Prisoners continued the discussion down in their housing areas for hours after the program was over with. This demonstrated the degree to which the prisoners were involved and interested to those of us who helped organize to say their own words. Those of us who were program staff always stayed behind after the sessions. We would proceed to clean the area and collect the equipment. It was always returned to the library for safekeeping. Once everything was packed and the area was cleaned, we would still have some time before we were forced to return to the prison housing areas. This led to a number of rap sessions developing between us and the outside participants, because the outside guests could not leave the prison until all the prisoners were accounted for back in the housing areas. The wait for the count to clear sometimes took as long as 45 minutes, and we would talk the whole time. Even as the outside people were going out the door to leave, there would still be a lively debate going on all the way up until the time the door was closed and cut off any further communication. Sometimes we would spend our time trying to find out how those outside participants felt about that evening's program or a previous session. They offered some of the best feedback about the sessions before they left. Many of us wanted to know how they felt about coming into a prison before the program and what their feelings were after the interaction with the prisoners. Some deep and profound changes took place in the space of 2 hours, resulting in lasting friendships and long-term ties between those of us inside and the outside guests. It was these occasions that we valued most, because for a few brief minutes, it seemed that we were not in the prison. The whole program created that feeling, but it was best felt during the time there was nothing to do but linger with our guests while waiting to return to the depressing conditions we still lived under. We hated for these times to end, because it was the one time we had some control over our own lives. We could exchange ideas freely and didn't need to act in a guarded manner as we would have had to do down in the prison population area. Because prisoners were always being transferred to other prisons or placed on lockup, and some were going home at their release time, the program suffered some turnover. The number of participants was always slipping down to 90 or so, and new people had to be added. The new participants often lacked the background and collective experiences of the other group members. Nevertheless, we used the long waiting list of prisoners we had and basically just rolled with the newcomers until they caught up and settled in. Those prisoners who are unable to get into the program because of size restraints from the administration were allowed to participate in all other activities we organized in the library related to the main program. These auxiliary programs allowed the extra prisoners on the waiting list to feel like they were a part of the program. Many guest speakers from the program made commitments to come in and help us with the various activities that we decided upon during the discussions. The brothers who felt strongest about this or that issue would come up in the library and get others involved in the planning and development of their projects. Usually, three or four speakers who had made commitments would come in, and a project would be born. One example of this is the case of a philosophy professor at Morgan State University. The debate was so hot on the night of his program that he promised to come back and teach some courses on philosophy and law. The prison population felt that academics worked for the dudes with the money, and that philosophical concepts were just in place to con us. The debate raged for an entire week, and finally this professor came back and a class was formed and booked full. After all the arrangements were made for a classroom and books for the students, the class started. It was to last only 15 sessions, but continued well beyond this time until, to say their own words, ended. The relationship established between the instructor and the students was a lasting one. In fact, the interaction between them was so deep that both sides changed as a result of this encounter. Some of the prisoners became serious philosophy students, and the professor became a member of the Moorish Science Temple. On another night, an equally interesting situation arose. The program was about the use of language, and during the course of the discussion, it was pointed out that oppressed people very rarely know a second language. The language used by the oppressors, in most cases, is similar, universal even. There was a keen interest in the use of language and concern about the lack of any second language skills among the over 100 men there that night. That evening, we agreed to see if we could find a language we could all learn and use. Since there were a number of Central American prisoners coming into the system, we thought that we would be well served by learning Spanish. Some were there because of the increasing drug traffic, and others were political refugees. These prisoners were not a large population, but they were coming in significant numbers and grouping up among themselves. They could speak openly about anything they wanted to, and we did not understand them. The brothers who were interested in the politics of oppression believed that they could use the language to help them with their ties and connections to progressive Latin American elements, while the criminal-minded brothers thought that this language would help them with their future drug deals. Whatever the motivation, a class was agreed upon, and about a dozen students signed up to learn Spanish. This was an ad hoc class, meaning that we used whatever books we could find and whatever space we could slip into from week to week. Finally, Brenda Vogel saw that we were serious about learning a second language, and she brought us some books and gave us a regular meeting time and space. This was a case where the brothers started something they thought would be beneficial to their development, and so they ran with it. The other people in the program saw it happening and joined in to support it. The class was a success, and a number of brothers did learn to speak Spanish. Many of our programs touched on the effects of slavery on people of African descent and the impact that it must have on the behavior of many of the prisoners across the nation. People of African descent were becoming the majority in U.S. prisons, and we all believe that slavery played a role in our lives in the present. The lack of economic opportunity and an education that was culturally relevant, combined with the trauma of slavery, lent easily to behavior that led to imprisonment. It was a setup for every hungry person in our community. We learned that under the 13th Amendment, we were still subjected to the legal conditions of slavery. How could that be possible in the late 20th century in the land of the free? Ironically, we had been telling people all along that we were being treated like slaves, and they thought we were simply being extreme. We were serious, but we had no idea that this treatment was permitted under the Constitution. The facts are that there was a small movement of people organizing to repeal that provision in the amendment. The Center Against Prisoner Slavery, CAPS, was an East Coast organization working on this effort. Members of our program soon made contact with people from that organization and invited them to come and speak to the group. We investigated their work and what other prisoners were doing to aid their efforts. There were mixed reactions to their work, since it seemed impossible to get an amendment repealed. 35 states would have to agree, and the effort was only underway in about a dozen states at that point. Nevertheless, a small group of us decided to work with the CAPS people, and we made up petitions and had everyone in the population sign them. We sent petitions to some of our supporters outside and gathered up as many names as possible for the drive. It was a good idea, but just too large a task for us to realistically tackle and be successful with. The one thing that we were sure of is that the amendment never got repealed, and the provision is still in effect today, and over 2 million prisoners are still held in slavery in America. To say their own words was, ultimately, a very positive program, and its impact can still be felt throughout the prison system. The ties that developed between prisoners and community members were strong and lasting. The library was able to continue to present programs for the prison population, following the lines of our original project, using the video cameras and sound equipment as needed. These offshoots of To Say Their Own Words would eventually become system-wide programs. An excellent example is the Black History Programming Initiative. Once the prisoners had begun to talk about things that related to themselves, it wasn't long before an attempt was made to gain an understanding of their history. First, a program on Malcolm X was held, then a program on black women who had made an impact on U.S. history, such as Sojourner Truth and Harriet Tubman, took place. These were followed by lectures and programs on the slave trade in Africa, and eventually a celebration of Kwanzaa. Finally, it was decided that we would do a series of programs for Black History Month. By the early 1980s, it seemed as though every community was trying to do some type of programming for Black History Month. The public school systems in most major urban areas, especially those with a majority black population, had already begun to make the programs a part of their yearly curriculum. Prisons were the last institutions to sponsor these programs. But once we got started, we were on a roll. We had a big task before us, since we had to rely on the people from the community to aid us in programming. We had a strong supporter on the outside who contacted people from all areas of the community and got them to commit to doing at least one Black History program for the prison. We soon developed a small group of community people who continued to work to get local community leaders and noted black educators in to do lectures on the subjects they thought we could use more information on.
You've been listening to Voices from Behind the Walls with your host, Albert Big Man Howard, also reading David Engels and Marty McReynolds. This is KWTF.net.